Hello and welcome to DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's show, LA is groaning with traffic and people. It's going to hell in a handbasket. Or is it? New problems bring new solutions, and DNA looks at some of the ways the Southland is adapting to its growing density. Coming up, we'll hear about the makeover of public transit and the explosion of new green public spaces. But first, the LA Auto Show has long been overshadowed by Detroit Show, when they were both in January. But this year, it's centennial. LA is getting an edge on the Motor City. It's opening in early December, and, says the LA Times auto critic Dan Neal, it promises to debut more new models than in the past, including this year a BMW 7 Series car run on hydrogen. I asked Dan if this means the dream of hydrogen-powered cars is becoming a reality.
No, it's a big waste of time, but it makes for really great auto show displays. Hydrogen technology has turned out to be something of a cul-de-sac in terms of automotive sustainability, particularly as battery technology has advanced so fast so far. People are asking, why would we use hydrogen when electricity is so much less troublesome in terms of the infrastructure? The interesting thing about the BMW project is that, unlike fuel cell cars that take hydrogen and reform it with oxygen and make electricity that way, it burns hydrogen in an internal combustion engine, much like you would use compressed natural gas to run a city bus. And so now there's some really complicated issues with that in terms of efficiency and losing energy along the way. But BMW seems to believe that this is the way they want to do it. And so we're going to see the results of that at the LA Auto Show.
Great. And I want to get back to some of the designs at the LA Auto Show. But before I do that, while we're on the topic of energy efficiency, there's been another innovation, as I understand it, this year, which has been the introduction into this country of clean diesel. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for fuel efficiency?
That's right. This fall, we saw the introduction of clean diesel. And it means a lot. If we could mainstream this technology into the fleet, we could really save some fuel.
Because I understand Audi is or has already introduced a clean diesel car.
Oh, yeah. Well, Audi and Mercedes-Benz. Audi won the 24 Hours of Le Mans this past year with a diesel-powered race car. The potential of this technology really isn't well appreciated in the U.S., whereas in Europe, about half the cars are powered with diesel. And you may think of it really as a hybrid in a different key. The hybrid cars typically have somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 35% better fuel efficiency or more, depending on the car. Same rate of efficiency is available with diesel power, and you also pay the same level of what you might call the diesel premium. You know, they're slightly more expensive than regular cars.
So back to the show. Is there anything that we might see at the auto show that could help lift any of the big American car companies out of the doldrums?
Well, it's a Gordian's knot. There are many things that have complicated the lives of the domestic manufacturers. One thing that people say is that domestic manufacturers need product. Well, the automakers are bringing new product on board, and some of them are quite good. For example, I drove a General Motors Saturn Ara a couple of weeks ago, a very, very competitive small sedan. GM's bringing out a hybrid SUV. But the real news, I mean, the huge news, and it's almost impossible to overstate this in terms of the sea change in attitude, General Motors will introduce in Detroit, probably not Los Angeles. We could be surprised. But they will introduce an electric car or a plug-in electric car or some hybrid electric vehicle that, all I have to say is this, think EV2.
The electric car was killed and now it's been resurrected?
Well, apparently so. I spent a couple of months ago, I spent an afternoon with Bob Lutz, who's vice chairman of General Motors, and not, I should say, previously, a huge fan of hybrid cars and just general this sort of progressive attitude toward powertrains. And he was talking about General Motors wholly embracing the electrification of the automobile. And I was sitting there just gobsmacked. I couldn't believe that he was having this. He was saying what he was saying. And I thought, great, about time.
And speaking of products relevant to the marketplace, back to LA, which has always had a very tight connection with the auto industry, despite the prominence of Detroit. Many companies maintain studios here. Many of today's car designers are alumni of the Art Center School of Design. What about that? What's the impact on car design coming from LA? And I think it's going to be represented at the auto show. Is that right?
Absolutely. One of the big ideas of the Art Center in Pasadena, this is the world's premier automotive design center, is this idea of sustainability in transportation. This year, the Design LA Challenge, that is the design competition that they have in association with the show, has given designers this challenge. Design a vehicle for the year 2015 that must be 100% recyclable and have a maximum lifespan of just 5 years. And so they have had entries from Audi and Acura and General Motors and how about this? The Hummer O2, right? It's not the H2, it's the O2. And dig this. This will be a car. This is a proposal for a car that drives around and converts carbon dioxide into oxygen. So if you're looking for a metric to appreciate how much the dialogue of Los Angeles vis-a-vis the automobile has changed the conversation, that's a good example. And so this is fascinating. I think it just goes to show that L.A., the L.A. Auto Show, is really coming into its own as kind of a another pole of thinking in the automotive consciousness. You know, Detroit is the big heavy iron town, the big engines and the hot rods, the Mustangs and the Camaros, all of which will be shown in Detroit. In Los Angeles, the audience is more sympathetic to a different automotive mode de vie. I'm looking forward to it.
Dan Neal, as always, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frances. Glad to be here.
Dan Neal is the Pulitzer Prize-winning auto critic for the Los Angeles Times. You may bump into him at the LA Auto Show starting December 1st. It may be a sign of the times that Art Center's famed auto design program is now called transportation design. Thinking of the car as the only means of mobility just doesn't cut it anymore, not even in LA, where public transit is now playing catch-up. The MTA, now called Metro, has quietly been upgrading its system and this year won the American Public Transportation Association's award for an outstanding public transportation system. So just how outstanding is it? Alyssa Walker is a production assistant on DNA. She blogs daily at the design blog unbeige.com and she writes for many publications. She recently got rid of her car and she travels everywhere by public transit. She's here today to give us a review of the system. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Frances.
So tell us, first of all, just how is it getting around everywhere on bus and subway?
Well, I was a little bit late today, as you know, but I would definitely say that it requires a little bit of planning, but it's a good experience. It's good to get out and be around other people, and it's interesting to see the city in a different way, and it gives you a chance to plan out your day ahead of time and
substantially ahead of time.
Absolutely.
Sometimes
because you do need to know where you're going,
and the trips that could take a long time in the car these days with the traffic as it is take even longer with the bus or the subway.
I'm not sure. I still have to do some more comparisons about how long it does take bus compared to car, but so far it's been at least equal. And the fact that you can utilize your time while you're in the bus or the subway is immensely more important to me than being in a car.
So let's talk about this. Well, let's start with the buses.
Well, what they've done, you might have noticed, they had the old bus fleet that was white with these just little pinstripes down the side, said Metro Bus or something. Now when the buses reach their half life of when they're on the road, they're brought in, they reupholster them with this great new fabric that they've had designed, and they paint them in one of three colors. You've seen the California Poppy, the Business Blue, the Rapid Red. And the new, if you get on a new bus, you get kind of excited when you see the new, you're going to get on a new bus coming. The experience is very different than what you might be used to being on an old, dirty, you know, possibly worn bus. The other thing that they have now are these, you know, the buses with the little hinges in the middle, which some people call the sexy flexi. The bus drivers call them the wigglies. And those are called articulated buses. And those are used for the rapid transit lines where, you know, less stops getting across the city. And the same kind of buses are used for the liner system, which is the Orange Line, of course.
Right. Orange Line, confusing because the buses themselves are red and silver, the sexy flexi, mm-hmm. articulated in the middle. And they have fabric that was on the seats that was designed by a local artist, mm-hmm. Pei White. Mm-hmm. But those buses really look kind of flash, you know.
Absolutely. They're hot. And people are really excited about them. And they realize that these are streamlined, kind of a callback to the, you know, trains that used to run all over L.A. in the 1920s when we had the best transportation system in the world, as they told me many times. And they are just kind of retro looking, really fun to ride. And the people that are on them, they love it. They really appreciate the design of them.
And key word here, trains. We're talking buses and yet you've brought up trains. My understanding from talking to the people at Metro as well is that they really wanted these buses to evoke trains. The idea being that buses have negative associations. Trains don't. They're the more seen as the more glamorous form of public transit. And they designed these buses to resemble trains. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think there's a weird stigma attached to the bus. But I'll tell you, traveling on these little dedicated streets out in the valley, the scenery is gorgeous. The bus is gorgeous. People are talking to each other. And it's not a bad it's not a bus experience. It's something very, very different.
Now, there's other parts of the city where it's less picturesque. And there's certain parts of the city where sort of the experience of waiting for the bus is not great. Really dismal bus stops. People standing there in the beating sun, being made to feel that they're lesser citizens by that experience. Is that, and often in places that might not even be that safe, is that something that Metro's thinking about, the bus stops as well as the buses?
Absolutely. You'll see, well, first of all, on the Orange Line, they did a very ambitious public art program to bring in local artists to make every single stop has its own character, fits in with the neighborhood, has a little bit of history about the valley. And their public art program, which has been around for a couple decades now, is really working to do that in across the board with whether you're going down underground for a subway stop, whether it's a greenway. You know, they do also do bikes and carpool lanes, things like that. So all through your moving through the day experience, they're trying to make sure that where you're sitting, where you're standing, what's above you, around you, is relevant to the neighborhood. It makes you feel good about traveling there. It looks safe. You know, it makes you feel safe. And they've really tried to, you know, improve the aesthetics of the experience from the bus to getting off of it and to getting on it again.
And these stops that you're describing, they provide shade from the sun and protection from the rain. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, what you're describing sounds great. Is it all in place? I don't get the impression it is. Is this something that's in process?
They've only been a design studio for about 4 years now, and everything is about 5 or 6 years behind. So everything they've started working on takes a long time to get put into place, and it could take years and money, of course.
But what you're saying is that tomorrow's public transit in LA will be rather different from the system that we've been used to.
It will be, and it's already, anyone who's lived here for more than 5 years, you've seen the changes. You've seen very thoughtful, very smart process that's gone into this already, and it's only going to get better.
Alyssa, it's great to talk to you about this. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Frances.
Alyssa is an invaluable production assistant on DNA. She blogs daily at the design blog unbeige.com. She writes for many other publications, and she is a new user of the public transit system in LA, and she'll be blogging about that too. Thanks, Alyssa.
Thanks, Frances.
You're listening to DNA, broadcast on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up after this break, we'll hear how LA is being transformed from a city of backyards into a city of parks. Plus, a native Angeleno's favourite building.
KCRW supporters include Cisco Home, the new retail showroom featuring Inside Green, a collection of fully sustainable 100% FSC-certified organic, handcrafted fine furniture. Cisco Home, located at 440 North La Brea. Other locations online at ciscohome.net.
I'm Frances Anderton, back with DNA. LA has not been known for public parks, but now plans are flowering for several large parks in the Southland, most of them on reclaimed industrialised land. One idea is for a park built over a section of the 101 freeway. I met with Don Scott, chair of the Hollywood Central Park Coalition, and he told me about their vision.
We're right over the freeway. You can hear the freeway, I would imagine, in the background. We're on Bronson Avenue, which is one of the streets that goes over the freeway. At this portion, this freeway is below the street level by about, I would say, 40, maybe 50 feet. And our dream is to put a 24-acre neighborhood park over the Hollywood Freeway from where we are now south to where the new Hollywood Central High School has just been built.
Another transformation of concrete to nature is taking place on the former El Toro Marine Corps Air Base in Irvine. The new Orange County Great Park is being designed by a team led by the landscape designer Ken Smith.
Now the whole site is, the whole former base is about 5,000 acres, and it's almost all flat. I mean, just total flat. And you go out to the middle where the two runways cross, and it's just awesome. I mean, it's so huge. It's just awe-inspiring, but at the same time, it's just oppressive because it's uninhabitable. You're out there and the sun's baking down on you, and you wonder how you could ever kind of keep the kind of grandness or the greatness of this huge space, but at the same time, how could you ever make it habitable? So our really big idea was to create a canyon, to actually using earthwork to create a space about 2.5 miles long that snakes all the way through the site, and it's a space that would be about 70 feet of grade change, partly digging down and partly piling up, and it would be planted with trees, and it would have a stream in the bottom with a series of small lakes, and you could go down into the space, into the shade, through the trees, to the water. And what's remarkable about these kind of spaces is it creates a microclimate, and you can feel the climate change. It just becomes comfortable.
And there's a state historic park planned for the cornfield site between Chinatown and the LA River to be seeded by the recently passed Prop 84. Despite its pastoral name, the cornfield was in fact once a rail yard and got its name from the corn seeds that fell from boxcars and sprouted. The winners of a design competition for the park have just been announced. It's the landscape architect George Hargreaves and his team, which includes Catherine Spitz.
Our team is seeking to transform these 32 acres of absolutely leftover land in the heart of Los Angeles into a park that's going to speak to the history of both the site and Los Angeles. It's going to provide connections to our river. We've got a series of wetlands and islands bringing water in from the river. We have a fauna bridge that connects us to the park, and we have bridges connecting us to Chinatown. And we're looking for a way to reflect all the different cultures that have come into Los Angeles, and also to at the same time create a park that's actually sustainable, which means that it will be able to be developed and built and planted and live into the next century. And part of that is the dream we have of making a park that relates to the past and also can relate to the future.
These parks are not yet built, and they're envisioned contingent on complex public-private financing that we don't have time to evaluate on this program. But why is there such interest in parks in LA, and why now? Mark Rios is a landscape architecture teacher at USC. He's the founder of the design and architecture firm Rios Clemente Hale Studios. which is designing the Civic Park at Grand Avenue and the outside spaces at LA Live in downtown.
It's really a unique time in the history of our city. Never before have we thought about adding so much public outdoor space. Originally, Los Angeles was a model where everyone had their own backyard, and we didn't need public parks as much as other cities do. But times have changed. Our city is becoming much denser. Our mayor is doing great work to really be an advocate for public transportation. We're talking about more dense housing nodes around those public transportation areas, and people need outdoor space. So it's very, very exciting to think about all these projects really changing the way we live in Los Angeles.
And that is to living more like in New York, going for an afternoon at Central Park.
Well, it's interesting. I think one of the downsides of Los Angeles has been somewhat of an isolated life. You're in your own car and you go to your house in your own backyard. We don't have a lot of places that are really communal public places in Los Angeles. Maybe the beach. But now we're really talking about adding all these public spaces where we can engage with each other, have fun outside together. I think it's a great time for the city.
So talk about these parks. We're not talking here green fields. We're talking about highly designed spaces involving architects, artists, landscape architects, gardeners, engineers, whole teams of people involved in the creation of these parks. Talk a bit about the design of these parks.
I think one of the things that's really unique about all the parks people are considering today is they serve more than just being green open space. The 19th century, we saw great parks like Central Park in New York, which were idealized places of nature. Today, the parks we're talking about will certainly have a lot of nature in them. There'll be outdoor gardens, but they also have a lot of other program roles for the city. They provide recreational space, they provide cultural space. Space is very, very precious. It's very expensive to build these parks, and so it needs to satisfy multiple goals for urban life.
And what's interesting about the Cornfield site is that this is proposed to be on reclaimed industrial land. Same with Orange County. Same if it happens with this Hollywood freeway cap. It's not exactly reclaimed land, but it's nonetheless creating a place of respite over a freeway. This direction to be taking industrialized land and turning them back into green space seems very exciting. Is that a kind of national trend? What do you think about this?
I think it's great. And when you think about it, it's the only way to go because all of our cities are so highly developed. You can't tear down existing communities and buildings and create new parks. And so you have to look at the land that is vacant now. And typically it is older industrial spaces that may have certain kinds of environmental problems associated with it. Parks today have all sorts of amazing biological and ecological ways to help clean the environment. And so if you can make a public space help improve some of the problems of the site, reclaim it and make it green and public, it's a great solution. This isn't a new idea, though. This is what happened with Central Park. Central Park, 100 years ago, was basically a slum. It was a really horrible place in Manhattan. And Frederick Law Olmsted, as a public act of cleaning up the city, basically proposed Central Park. So this is sort of an established pattern in park design of looking at places in our communities that are problematic and using nature as a way to reclaim them and improve them.
Creating these parks, particularly transforming industrialized land back into parks, must involve extraordinary amounts of engineering. What kinds of challenges might be faced by the designers in creating these parks?
I think one of the first challenges is that you may not be able to initially occupy the park, and that a lot of the park proposals that are for reclaimed land, there may be a period of time, 5 years or 10 years or even 15 years, where the land is repairing itself and it may not be accessible to the public. Typically, there is a long timeline associated with these projects. That part of the park might be open initially, a second phase might be open after 5 more years as the park becomes cleaner and cleaner. One of the processes here is trying to expose the toxins, find some way of remediating them, often by planting different kinds of plant material that may help that, other through much more aggressive methods of just extraction. And so it's not like you're going to have an instant park that's going to be open, you can move in and enjoy. It's going to take time.
Mark Rios is a landscape architecture teacher at USC, and his firm, Rios Clemente Hale Studios, is designing the Civic Park at Grand Avenue and the outside spaces at LA Live in downtown. We'll hear more about those projects on a future DNA. And now it's time for our favourite building in LA. This month, chosen by John Borden. He's a special ed teacher in a public elementary school. Hi, John. So tell us about your favourite building.
It would be the Eastern Building, which I think is also called the Eastern Columbia Building in downtown.
And what is that building?
It's a huge Art Deco building, I believe, on Broadway. And I first noticed it years and years ago. I used to go downtown to the different watch and clock supply houses downtown in the jewelry district to get repairs done for some of the antique wristwatches I collect. And I noticed that building because it looks exactly like a lot of the Art Deco American watches I have.
What is it about the building that gives it that quality?
It's just got this huge clock tower on the front, huge exaggerated numbers, very squared off, very symmetrical, very much of an Art Deco style. And then the building is just this solid blue building in the midst of all these other old hotels and office buildings and buildings in the jewelry mart downtown. So it's impossible to miss it.
And are you an Angeleno of many years?
Yeah, I was born here. I'm native to Los Angeles, yep.
And do you tend to like its architecture or no?
Although I think, unfortunately, we don't do enough to preserve the really historic buildings that are here, and many of them have gone by the wayside and have been replaced by, you know, other more modern structures or parking lots, or they don't seem to preserve and appreciate the really old, interesting buildings as much here as they do in some other cities or some other countries.
But the Eastern Building is still standing. I think
yeah.
It's being converted, isn't it? I think it's going to be lofts.
Is it? Oh, good. Yeah, anything that'll keep them still there and, you know, able to be appreciated years after they were built.
That works for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. Well, John Borden, thank you so much for telling us about your favourite building.
Right, thank you.
The Eastern Columbia Building is at 849 South Broadway. It was designed by Claude Bielman and opened in 1930. Now, the development company, The Core Group, is turning it into condominiums that are scheduled to be completed early next year. And to conclude this month's show, I'll just run over a couple of calendar items. Next month, the Billy Wilder Theatre opens. That's a swank screening cave at the Hammer Museum with hot pink seats designed by LA architect Michael Moltzen, who incidentally is the architect on the team that just won the Cornfield Park project. Dave Eggers will give a reading there on December 10th. And following a glammy party last Saturday night at the Geffen Contemporary, Mocha has just opened its new show Skin and Bones, a look at parallel practices in architecture and fashion. And on December 7th at SciArc, you can meet some of Dwell Magazine's nice modernists. That is, people helping society through modern design. I'll be co-hosting with Dwell Editor-in-Chief Sam Graw. For more on these and other events, see our calendar on the Design and Architecture webpage. To get there, go to kcrw.com and click on A to Z. You can also stream or podcast today's and past shows on that page. Or you can podcast the show on iTunes. If you want to comment on design and architecture, write me at dna@kcrw.org. That is DNA, the letters DNA@kcrw.org. Thanks very much for listening to today's show. It was produced by Jennifer Ferrer and Ray Guana, with production assistance from Melissa Walker. Thanks to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website. I'm Frances Anderton. Have a great Thanksgiving and join me next month for more DNA.
The Norton Simon Museum presents The Collectible Moment, a first-ever survey of the museum's photography collection, featuring 150 photographs by such artists as Ansel Adams, Louis Baltz, Manuel Alvarez Bravo, Imogen Cunningham, Judy Dater, Robert Heineken, Anthony Hernandez, Edward Weston, and Minor White. The Collectible Moment is the largest and most extensive photography exhibition in the museum's history, now through February 26th. Info at nortonsimon.org.